Galt remained motionless, not extending his hand for the papers. "These are just plain, ordinary people, Mr. Galt," said Chick Morrison, in a tone intended to project their abject humility. "They can't tell you what to do. They wouldn't know. They're merely begging you. They may be weak, helpless, blind, ignorant. But you, who are so intelligent and strong, can't you take pity on them? Can't you help them?"
"By dropping my intelligence and following their blindness?"
"They may be wrong, but they don't know any better."
"But I, who do, should obey them."
"I can't argue, Mr. Galt. I'm just begging for your pity. They're suffering. I'm begging you to pity those who suffer. Mr. Galt," he asked, noticing that Galt was looking off at the distance beyond the window, and that his eyes were suddenly implacable. "What's the matter? What are you thinking of?"
"Hank Reardon."
Why?
"Did they feel any pity for Hank Reardon?"
"Oh, but that's different. He—"
"Shut up," said Galt evenly.
"I only—"
"Shut up," snapped Mr. Thompson.
"Don't mind him, Mr. Galt. He hasn't slept for two nights. He's scared out of his wits."
Dr. Floyd Ferris next day did not seem to be scared. But it was worse, thought Mr. Thompson. He observed that Galt remained silent and would not answer Ferris at all. "It's the question of moral responsibility that you might not have studied sufficiently, Mr. Galt," Dr. Ferris was drawling, in too airy, too forced a tone of casual informality. "You seem to have talked on the radio about nothing but sins of commission, but there are also the sins of omission to consider. To fail to save a life is as immoral as to murder. The consequences are the same, and since we must judge actions by their consequences, the moral responsibility is the same. For instance, in view of the desperate shortage of food, it has been suggested that it might become necessary to issue a directive ordering that every third one of all children under the age of 10 and of all adults over the age of 60 be put to death to secure the survival of the rest. You wouldn't want this to happen, would you? You can prevent it. One word from you would prevent it. If you refuse and all those people are executed, it will be your fault and your moral responsibility."
"You're crazy," screamed Mr. Thompson, recovering from shock and leaping to his feet. "Nobody's ever suggested any such thing. Nobody's ever considered it. Please, Mr. Galt, don't believe him. He doesn't mean it."
"Oh, yes, he does," said Galt. "Tell the bastard to look at me, then look in the mirror, then ask himself whether I would ever think that my moral stature is at the mercy of his actions."
"Get out of here," cried Mr. Thompson, yanking Ferris to his feet. "Get out. Don't let me hear another squeak out of you."
He flung the door open and pushed Ferris at the startled face of a guard outside. Turning to Galt, he spread his arms and let them drop with a gesture of drained helplessness. Galt's face was expressionless.
"Look," said Mr. Thompson pleadingly, "isn't there anybody who can talk to you?"
"There's nothing to talk about."
"We've got to. We've got to convince you. Is there anyone you'd want to talk to?"
"No."
"I thought maybe. It's because she talks. Used to talk, like you at times. Maybe if I sent Miss Dagny Taggart to tell you?"
"That one? Sure she used to talk like me. She's my only failure. I thought she was the kind who belonged on my side, but she double-crossed me to keep her railroad. She'd sell her soul for her railroad. Send her in if you want me to slap her face."
"No, no, no. You don't have to see her if that's how you feel. I don't want to waste more time on people who rub you the wrong way. Only if it's not Miss Taggart, I don't know whom to pick. If I could find somebody you'd be willing to consider, or—"
"I've changed my mind," said Galt. "There is somebody I'd like to speak to."
"Who?"
cried Mr. Thompson eagerly. "Dr. Robert Stadler." Mr. Thompson emitted a long whistle and shook his head apprehensively.
"That one is no friend of yours," he said in a tone of honest warning.
"He's the one I want to see."
"Okay, if you wish. If you say so. Anything you wish, I'll have him here tomorrow morning."
That evening, dining with Wesley Mooch in his own suite, Mr. Thompson glared angrily at a glass of tomato juice placed before him.
"What, no grapefruit juice?" he snapped.
His doctor had prescribed grapefruit juice as protection against an epidemic of colds.
"No grapefruit juice," said the waiter with an odd kind of emphasis.
"Fact is," said Mooch bleakly, "that a gang of raiders attacked a train at the Taggart Bridge on the Mississippi. They blew up the track and damaged the bridge. Nothing serious. It's being repaired. But all traffic is held up, and the trains from Arizona can't get through. It's ridiculous. Aren't there any other?"
Mr. Thompson stopped. He knew that there were no other railroad bridges across the Mississippi. After a moment, he spoke up in a staccato voice. "Order army detachments to guard the bridge, day and night. Tell them to pick their best men for it. If anything happened to that bridge..." He did not finish. He sat hunched, staring down at the costly china plates and the delicate hors d'oeuvres before him. The absence of so prosaic a commodity as grapefruit juice had suddenly made real to him for the first time what it was that would happen to the city of New York if anything happened to the Taggart Bridge. "Dagny," said Eddie Willers that evening, "the bridge is not the only problem." He snapped on her desk lamp, which, in forced concentration on her work, she had neglected to turn on at the approach of dusk. "No transcontinental trains can leave San Francisco. One of the fighting factions out there, I don't know which one, has seized our terminal and imposed a departure tax on trains, meaning that they're holding trains for ransom. Our terminal manager has quit. Nobody knows what to do there now."
"I can't leave New York," she answered stonily.
"I know," he said softly. "That's why it's I who'll go there to straighten things out. At least to find a man to put in charge."
"No, I don't want you to. It's too dangerous."
"And what for? It doesn't matter now. There's nothing to save. It's still Taggart Transcontinental. I'll stand by it. Dagny, wherever you go, you'll always be able to build a railroad. I couldn't. I don't even want to make a new start. Not anymore. Not after what I've seen."
"You should."
"I can't. Let me do what I can."
"Eddie, don't you want..."
She stopped, knowing that it was useless.
"All right, Eddie, if you wish."
"I'm flying to California tonight. I've arranged for space on an army plane. I know that you will quit as soon as you can leave New York. You might be gone by the time I return. When you're ready, just go. Don't worry about me. Don't wait to tell me. Go as fast as you can. I'll say goodbye to you now." She rose to her feet. They stood facing each other. In the dim half-light of the office, the picture of Nathaniel Taggart hung on the wall between them. They were both seeing the years since that distant day when they had first learned to walk down the track of a railroad. He inclined his head and held it lowered for a long moment. She extended her hand.
"Goodbye, Eddie."
He clasped her hand firmly, not looking down at his fingers. He was looking at her face. He started to go, but stopped, turned to her and asked, his voice low but steady, neither as plea nor as despair, but as a last gesture of conscientious clarity to close a long ledger. "Dagny, did you know how I felt about you?"
"Yes,"
she said softly, realizing in this moment that she had known it, wordlessly, for years.
"I knew it."
"Goodbye, Dagny." The faint rumble of an underground train went through the walls of the building and swallowed the sound of the door closing after it. It was snowing next morning, and melting drops were like an icy cutting torch on the temples of Dr. Robert Stadler as he walked down the long corridor of the Wayne Falkland Hotel toward the door of the Royal Suite. Two husky men walked by his sides. They were from the Department of Morale Conditioning, but did not trouble to hide what method of conditioning they would welcome a chance to employ.
"Just remember Mr. Thompson's orders," one of them told him contemptuously. "One wrong squawk out of you, and you'll regret it, brother."
It was not the snow on his temples, thought Dr. Stadler. It was a burning pressure. It had been there since that scene last night when he had screamed to Mr. Thompson that he could not see John Galt. He had screamed in blind terror, begging a circle of impassive faces not to make him do it, sobbing that he would do anything but that. The faces had not condescended to argue or even to threaten him. They had merely given him orders. He had spent a sleepless night telling himself that he would not obey. But he was walking toward that door. The burning pressure on his temples and the faint, dizzying nausea of unreality came from the fact that he could not recapture the sense of being Dr. Robert Stadler.